yells at one point, "Donald Trump is not an asshole." I find this funny, but at the same time surprising. Regardless of whether you voted for him, I thought the president-elect's identity as a despicable human being was something we could all agree on. I mean, he pretty much ran on it. Later in our argument, my father shouts, "He's the best thing that's happened to this country in years, and it was just locker room talk." I'm in locker rooms 5 days a week and have never heard anyone carry on like Trump in that video, I argue. And if I did, I wouldn't think, "Wow, that guy ought to be my president." I'd think he was a creep and a loser. Then I add, repeating something I'd heard from someone else, "Besides, he wasn't in a locker room. He was at work." Since I left the United States in 1998, I've cast absentee ballots. Americans overseas vote from the last state they lived in, which for me was New York. Then we got the house on Emerald Isle, and I changed my location to North Carolina, where I'm more inclined to feel hopeless. In 1996, in line at the grocery store in Lower Manhattan, I'd look at the people in front of me thinking, "Bill Clinton voter, Bill Clinton voter, convicted felon, Bill Clinton voter, foreign tourist, felon, felon, Bill Clinton voter, felon." At the Emerald Isle supermarket that I stomp off to after the fight with my father, it's Trump, 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 and then the cashier, who also voted for him. Of course, these are just my assumptions. The guy in the T-shirt that pictures a semi-automatic rifle above the message, "Come and take it." The one in fatigues, buying 2 12-packs of beer and a tub of rice pudding, didn't necessarily vote Republican. He could have just stayed home on election day and force-fed the women he holds captive in the crawlspace beneath his living room. The morning after our argument, I come downstairs to find my father in the kitchen. "Are you still talking to me?" he asks. I look at him as if he were single-handedly responsible for the election of Donald Trump, as if he had knowingly cast the tie-breaking vote and all of what is to come is entirely his fault. Then I say, "Yes, of course I'm still talking to you." He turns and plods into the living room. Horse's ass. 9. On Christmas morning at home in England, I climb into the loft space above the bedroom in search of some presents I'd wrapped months earlier. The ladder I'm using is wooden and has only 2 legs, which slip on my freshly waxed floor. I fall from a height of 9 feet and land with a bang on my left side, fracturing 8 ribs. As I lie on the floor, stunned and in the greatest pain of my life, it occurs to me that I might die before Trump assumes office and that maybe that won't be such a terrible thing. Amy runs out of the guest room then, and Hugh charges up the stairs from the kitchen, both of them asking, "What happened, and are you all right?" I don't want to ruin Christmas, so say, "I'm fine. I'm fine." Fine people, though, don't need 10 minutes to get off the floor. Hugh phones the NHS, the National Health Service, and after being asked a number of preliminary questions, I'm put through to a nurse named Mary. "Who are you again?" I ask. "Mary," she repeats, not, I notice, Mary Stewart or whatever her last name is. Everything in America is based on lawsuits, on establishing a trail. In the United States, I'd be told to come in immediately for x-rays, but in England, they figure that unless you're unconscious or leaking great quantities of fluid, blood, pus, etc., there's no point in wasting everyone's time. Mary asks me a number of questions to determine whether I pierced a lung, which apparently I have not. "But it really hurts when I cough," I tell her. "Well, David," she says brightly, "then my advice to you would be not to cough and to have a lovely Christmas." I later learned that what I suffered was called blunt force trauma. It's remarkably similar to how I felt after the election, as if I'd been slammed against a wall or hit by a car. Both pains persist, show no signs, in fact, of ever going away. The damage is permanent. I will never be the same as I was before the election / accident. A lovely Christmas is out of the question. Every day, I lie on the floor and clutch my sides, stunned. 10. I hold on to the most unreasonable hope, The Electoral College will come to its senses and say, we can't let this happen. It will turn out that Russia tampered with our voting machines, yet nothing stops the advancing truck. On Inauguration Day, I am in Seattle. Late in the afternoon, my old friend Lynn sends me a photo of an anti-Trump sticker someone found in Japan. It's cleverly designed, three peaks that on second glance turn out to be Trump sandwiched between two Klansmen. I want to write back and say, ha, but instead, as a joke, I respond, Dear Lynn, I'm sorry you're so opposed to change or too small-minded to move past your narrow assumptions. In the future, I'd appreciate your keeping things like this to yourself. David. A minute later, I send a follow-up email that says, Just kidding. And it bounces back. As do the next three emails I send. She's blocked me, I realize, after 38 years of friendship. I go to bed that night and lie awake, worried that she's telling everyone I'm a Trump supporter. The news will spread, and by morning, I'll be ruined. But it was just a joke, I say to myself in the dark room. A horrible, horrible joke. Why aren't you laughing? From the outside, our house on the North Carolina coast, the C-section, is nothing much to look at. It might have been designed by a 10-year-old with a ruler. That's how basic it is. Walls, roof, windows, deck. It's easy to imagine the architect putting down his crayon and shouting into the next room, I'm done! Can I watch TV now? Whenever I denigrate the place, he reminds me that it's the view that counts, the ocean we look out at. I see his point, but it's not like you have to limit yourself to one or the other. What about West Sussex, I say. From the outside, our cottage in England resembles something you'd find in a storybook, a home for pot-bellied trolls, benevolent ones that smoke pipes. Built of stone in the late 16th century, it has a pitched roof and little windows with panes the size of playing cards. We lie in bed and consider sheep grazing in the shadow of a verdant down. I especially love being there in winter, so it bothered me when I had to spend most of January and February working in the United States. Hugh came along, and toward the end we found ourselves on Maui, where I had a reading. I'd have been happy just to fly in and fly out, but Hugh likes to swim in the ocean, so we stayed for a week in a place he found online. Let me guess, the box office manager of the theater I performed at said. It's spread out over at least four levels and paneled in dark wood like something you'd see on a 1970s TV show, right? He'd hit it squarely on the nose, especially the dark part. The wood on the interior walls had been rigorously stained and was almost the color of fudge, a stark contrast to the world outside, which was relentlessly, almost oppressively bright. As for the various levels, any excuse seemed to have been taken to add stairs, even if only two or three. If you lived there full time, you'd no doubt get the hang of them. As it was, I tripped or fell down at least twice a day. The house reminded me of the condominium units my family used to rent on Emerald Isle when I was in my 20s, though none of those had a crucifix hanging in the kitchen. This one was 10 inches tall and supported a slender, miserable Christ, plated in bronze. That was the only decoration, aside from a number of framed photo collages of the owner and his family taken over the years. They were a good-looking group, one that multiplied as the children grew and had kids of their own. The color in the earlier snapshots had faded, just as it has in pictures of my own family, same haircuts, same flared slacks and shirts with long droopy collars, only now drained of their vibrancy like lawns in winter. Each generation looked healthy and prosperous, yet I found myself wondering what lurked beneath the surface, for surely there was something. Which of you is in prison now? I'd ask, glancing up as I tripped on the stairs to the bedroom. The house was on the ocean, and the beach that began where the backyard ended was shaded with palms. Most often it was deserted, so except for a few short trips up the coast for supplies, Hugh stayed put during our week on Maui. If he wasn't on the deck overlooking the water, he was in the water, looking back at the deck. He saw whales and sea turtles. He snorkeled. My only accomplishment was to sign my name to 5,000 blank sheets of paper sent by my publisher, Tip-Ins, they're called. A month or two down the line, they'd be bound into copies of the book I had just about finished. There were still a few more weeks to make changes, but they could only be minor grammatical things. Hugh, who was good at spotting typos and used to do so for his father, a novelist, was reading the manuscript for the first time. Whenever I heard him laugh, I'd ask, "What's so funny?" Should 5 or 10 minutes pass with no reaction, I'd call out, "Why aren't you laughing?" It takes quite a while to sign your name 5,000 times, so I set myself a daily goal and would stop whatever I was doing every 2 hours and pick up my magic marker. Often, while autographing, I'd listen to the radio or watch a TV show I like called Intervention. In it, real-life alcoholics and drug addicts are seen going about their business. Most are too far gone to hold down jobs, so mainly we see them starting fights, crying on unmade beds, and shooting up in hard-to-spot places like the valleys between their toes. Amazing, to me, is that anyone would allow him or herself to be filmed in this condition. "Did you catch me on TV?" I'd imagine them saying to their friends. "Wasn't it incredible when I shit on that car?" That's what a 31-year-old drunk woman did in one of the episodes I watched as I signed blank sheets of paper, pulled down her pants, positioned herself just so, and defecated on the rear bumper of a parked Audi A4. As she went at it, a diamond shape blurring her from the waist down, I thought of my mother, in part because she was a lady. By this I mean that she never wore pants, just skirts and dresses. She never left the house without makeup on and her hair styled. Whenever I see a young woman boarding a plane in her pajamas or a guy in a T-shirt that reads, "Your hole is my goal," I always wonder what Mom would think. She's been dead for almost 30 years, so she missed a lot of the build-up to what is now thought of as less than scandalous behavior. I once watched a show in which a group of young men were sent out to collect pubic hair. It was a contest of sorts, and in the end, the loser had to put all the spoils on a pizza and eat it. That was in 2003, so to me, someone on television shitting on a car, sure, okay, that makes sense. To go there straight from murder, she wrote, however, would be quite a shock. Another reason Intervention makes me think about my mother is that she was an alcoholic. It's a hard word to use for someone you love, and so my family avoided it. Rather, we'd whisper among ourselves that Mom had a problem, that she could stand the cutback. Sober, she was cheerful and charismatic, the kind of person who could and would talk to anyone. Unlike our father, who makes jokes no one understands and leaves his listeners baffled and eager to get away, it was fun to hear what our mom might come out with. "I got them laughing," was a popular line in the stories she'd tell at the end of the day. The men who pumped her gas, the bank tellers, the receptionists at the dentist's office, "I got them laughing." Her specialty was the real-life story, perfected and condensed. These take work, and she'd go through a half-dozen verbal drafts before getting one where she wanted it. Over the course of the day, the line she wished she'd delivered in response to some question or comment, the zinger, would become the line she had delivered. "So I said to him, 'Buddy, that's why they invented the airplane.'" We'd be on the sidelines aghast. "That's not how it happened at all." But what did it matter with such great results? You'd think my mother could have seen the difference between the sunny, likable her and the dark one who'd call late at night. I could hear the ice cubes in her glass rushing forth whenever she took a sip. In my youth, when she joined my father for a drink after work, "Just one, I have to get dinner on the table," that was a happy sound. Now it was like a trigger being cocked. The little bitch, my mother would say, her voice slurred, referring to someone she might have spoken to that afternoon or maybe 5 years earlier, a shop clerk, a neighbor, talking to me that way, like that, like I'm nothing. She doesn't know it, but I could buy and sell her. Fly home for a visit and you'd find her in the kitchen, slamming around, replaying some argument she'd had with our father. Goddamn bastard, shove it up your ass, why don't you? You and your stinking, why hire a plumber when I can do it myself? You can't do it yourself, you hear me, buddy? You can't. Late in her life, my mother embraced the word fuck, but could never quite figure out its place in a sentence. So I said to him, I don't give a damn fuck what you do with it. Just get it the hell out of my driveway. By that point in the evening, she'd look different, raw, like you'd taken the lady she was earlier and peeled her. The loafers she favored would have been kicked off, and she'd be in her stocking feet, hands on the counter to steady herself as she raged. She was hardly ever angry at the person she was talking to, exceptions being my brother Paul, my father, and my sister Tiffany. Rather, she'd be looking for support. Can you believe this shit? I mean, can you? We didn't dare contradict her. I have an English friend named Ingrid, and her father was an alcoholic. When he lost his license for driving drunk, he got himself a tricycle and would pedal it back and forth to a pub, everyone in the village watching. Not a regular bike, I asked. He would have fallen off, Ingrid told me, relieved to be at the stage where she could laugh about it. Her father was a horrible person, a mean clown, which makes it easier, in a way. Our mother did nothing so cartoonish, and if she had, we'd have felt traitorous making fun of her. Instead, we separated her into two people and discounted what the second drunk one did, for that wasn't really her, we reasoned, but a kind of virus talking. Her father had it, too, and drank until men in white coats carted him off to the state hospital where he received shock treatments. I look at pictures of him after his release and think, wait, that's me. We didn't resemble each other when I was young, but now we could be twins. The big moment on intervention is when family and friends of the alcoholic or drug addict confront him or her. It's supervised by a counselor and often takes place in a sad hotel conference room with flesh-colored furniture and no windows. The addicts are usually in full blossom, drunk or high or on the nod. What the hell? They say, looking around at their parents, their brothers and sisters, their wives or husbands, all together, seated in a semicircle. The subjects of the intervention already feel ambushed, so steps are taken to keep them from feeling attacked as well. It's easy to lose one's temper in this situation, so the counselor has instructed the friends and family members to organize their thoughts on paper. The letters they read are never wholly negative and usually kick off with a pleasant memory. I remember when you were brought home from the hospital is a big one. This is the equivalent of a short story beginning with the main character's alarm clock going off, and though I know I shouldn't get hung up on this part of the show, I do. Oh, please, I think, rolling my eyes as the combative meth addict is told, you had a smile that could light up a room. The authors of the letters often cry, perhaps because what they've written is so poorly constructed. Then again, reality TV is fueled by tears. Take another of the shows I like, My 600-Pound Life, about morbidly obese people struggling with their weight. At the start of each program, loved ones appear, always weeping, always saying the exact same thing. I don't want to have to bury my own child, / sister, / nephew, etc. Yes, well, I wouldn't either, I think. If digging the grave didn't do me in, I'd surely die trying to roll that massive body into it. There's crying on hoarders as well, though rarely by the pack rat, who sees no downside to saving all his used toilet paper. After everyone on intervention has had their say, the addicts are offered a spot in a rehab center. Not all of them accept, but most do. The places they're sent to tend to be sunny, Arizona, Southern California, Florida. We see them 2 months into their stay, most looking like completely different people. Here are the wind chimes I made in my arts and crafts group, the woman who earlier in the program was seen shooting speed into her neck says. Not everyone stays the prescribed 90 days. Some leave early and relapse. Others get out on schedule and relapse a week or 6 months later. The hardiest of them are revisited several years down the line, still sober, many with jobs now and children. All that time I wasted, they say. What on earth was I thinking? I asked Ingrid once if she ever talked to her father about his drinking, and I think she was ashamed to answer no. Not that I or anyone in my family ever confronted my mother, no matter how bad it got. Even my dad, who's super direct and tells complete strangers if they're loud or wrong or too fat for that bolero jacket, said nothing. Then again, it built so gradually. For as long as I was living at home, it never seemed a problem. It was only after 5 of her 6 children had left that she upped her quota. The single scotch before dinner became 2, and then 3. Her wine intake doubled, tripled. She was never a quality drinker. Quantity was what mattered. She bought jugs, not bottles. After dinner, she'd switch to coffee, and then back to scotch or wine, supplementing the alcohol with pills. Mom's dolls, we called them. When she told us that she would no longer drive at night, that she couldn't see the road, we all went along with it, knowing the real reason was that by sunset she was in no shape to get behind the wheel. Gosh, we said, we hope that doesn't happen to our eyes when we're your age. In that respect, you have to hand it to the family members on intervention. Corny letters notwithstanding, they have guts. The person they're confronting might storm out of the room and never talk to them again, but at least they're rolling the dice. Though we never called our mother on her behavior, she knew that we noticed it. I haven't had a drink in 4 days, she'd announce out of nowhere, usually over the phone. You could hear the struggle and the hope in her voice. I'd call her the next night and could tell right away that she'd lost her willpower. Why aren't you stronger? I wanted to ask. I mean, really, can't you just try harder? Of course, I was drunk too, so what could I say? I suppose I felt that my youth made it less sad. The vast plain of adulthood stretched before me while she was well into her 50s, drinking alone in a house filled with crap. Even sober, she'd rail against that, all the junk my father dragged home and left in the yard or the basement, old newspapers and magazines, toaster ovens picked out of the trash, hoses, sheets of plywood, all of it perfectly good, all of it just what he needed. In my mind, our house used to be so merry. There was music playing in every room, the phone was always ringing. People in my family laughed more than people in other families. I was as sure of that as I was of anything. Up and down the street, our neighbors left their dinner tables as soon as they could and beat it for the nearest TV. That's what my father did, while the rest of us stayed put with our mother, vying for her attention as the candles burned down. Group therapy, she called it, though it was more like a master class. One of us would tell a story about our day, and she'd interject every now and then to give notes. You don't need all that detail about the bedroom, she'd say, or maybe it's best to skip the part about the teacher and just cut to the chase. Pour me a cup of coffee, she'd say, come 10 o'clock, our empty plate still in front of us. Get me another pack of Winstons from the pantry, will you? One of the perks of having 6 kids was that you didn't have to locate anything on your own. Find my car keys, she'd command, or someone get me a pair of shoes. There was never a rebellion because it was her asking. Pleasing our mother was fun and easy and made us feel good. I'll light her cigarette. No, I will. Maybe ours wasn't the house I'd have chosen had I been in charge of things. It wasn't as clean as I'd have liked. From the outside, it wasn't remarkable. We had no view. But still, it was the place I held in mind, and proudly, when I thought home. It had been a living organism, but by the time I hit my late 20s, it was rotting, a dead tooth in a row of seemingly healthy ones. When I was 11, my father planted a line of olive bushes in front of the house. They were waist high and formed a kind of fence. By the mid-80s, they were so overgrown that pedestrians had to quit the sidewalk and take to the street instead. People with trash to drop waited until they reached our yard to drop it, figuring the high grass would cover whatever beer can or plastic bag of dog shit they needed to discard. It was like the Addams Family house, which would have been fine had it still been Mary, but it wasn't anymore. Our mother became the living ghost that haunted it, gaunt now and rattling ice cubes instead of chains. I'd come home from Chicago where I was living, and she would offer to throw a dinner party for my friends. "Invite the Sieglers," she'd say, and, "Hey, Dean or Lynn, I haven't seen her in a while." She was lonely for company, so I'd pick up the phone. By the time my guests arrived, she'd be wasted. My friends all noticed it. How could they not? Sitting at the table as she repeated a story for the third time, I got them laughing. Watching as she stumbled, as the ash of her cigarette fell onto the floor, I'd cringe and then feel guilty for being embarrassed by her. Had I not once worn a top hat to meet her at the airport, a top hat and suspenders, with red platform shoes? I was 17 that year, but still, and how many times had I been drunk or high at the table? Wasn't it maybe my turn to be the embarrassed one? Must remain loyal, I'd think. The morning after a dinner party, her makeup applied but still in her robe, my mother would be sheepish. "Well, it was nice to see Dean again." That would have been the perfect time to sit her down, to say, "Do you remember how out of control you were last night? What can we do to help you?" I'm forever thinking of all our missed opportunities, 6 kids and a husband, and not one of us spoke up. I imagine her at a rehab center in Arizona or California, a state she'd never been to. "Who knew I'd be so good at pottery?" I can hear her saying, and "I'm really looking forward to rebuilding my life." Sobriety would not have stopped the cancer that was quietly growing inside her, but it would have allowed her to hold her head up, to recall what it felt like to live without shame, if only for a few years. "Do you think it was my fault that she drank?" my father asked not long ago. It's the assumption of an amateur, someone who stops after his second vodka tonic and quits taking his pain medication before the prescription runs out. It's almost laughable, this insistence on a reason. I think my mother was lonely without her children, her fan club. But I think she drank because she was an alcoholic. "How can you watch that crap?" he would say whenever he walked into the house on Maui and caught me in front of intervention. "Well, I'm not only watching it," I'd tell him. "I'm also signing my name." This was never enough for him. "You're in Hawaii, sitting indoors in the middle of the day. Get out of here, why don't you? Get some sun." And so I'd put on my shoes and take a walk, never on the beach, but along the road or through residential neighborhoods. I saw a good deal of trash, cans, bottles, fast food wrappers, the same junk I see in England. I saw flattened cane toads with tire treads on them. I saw small birds with brilliant red heads. One afternoon, I pushed an SUV that had stalled in traffic. The driver was perhaps in his mid-20s and was talking on the phone when I offered a hand. He nodded, so I took up my position at the rear and remembered after the first few yards what a complete pain in the ass it is to help someone in need. I thought he'd just steer to the curb, but instead he went another 100 or so feet down the road where he turned the corner. "Does he expect me to push him all the way home?" I asked myself, panting. Eventually, he pulled over and put on the brake. The guy never thanked me or even put down his phone. "Asshole," I thought. Back at the house, I took another stack of papers and started signing my name to them. "That's not your signature," Hugh said, frowning over my shoulder. "It's what's become of my signature," I told him, looking at the scrawl in front of me. You could sort of make out a D and an S, but the rest was like a silhouette of a mountain range or a hospital patient's medical chart just before he's given the bad news. In my defense, it never occurred to me that I'd be signing my name 5,000 times, in the course of my entire life maybe, but not in one shot. This was not the adulthood that I had predicted for myself, an author of books, spending a week in Hawaii with his handsome, longtime boyfriend before deciding which house to return to. I had wished for it, sure, but I'd also wished for a complete head transplant. Hugh had made himself a Manhattan and was sitting on the patio with my manuscript. A minute passed, then two, then five. "Why aren't you laughing?" I called. I was living in New York, still broke and unpublished, when my mother died. Aside from the occasional Sidney Sheldon novel, she wasn't a reader, so she didn't understand the world I was fluttering around the edges of. If she thought it was hopeless or that I was wasting my time writing, she never said as much. My father, on the other hand, was more than happy to predict a dismal future. Perhaps it was despite him that she supported us in our far-fetched endeavors, art school for me and Gretchen, Amy at Second City. Just when we needed money, at the moment before we had to ask for it, checks would arrive. "A little something to see you through," the accompanying notes would read. "Love, your old mother." Was she sober in those moments, I wondered, signing my name to another sheet of paper? Was it with a clear mind that she believed in us, or was it just the booze talking? The times I miss her most are when I see something she might have liked, a piece of jewelry or a painting, the view of a white sand beach off a balcony, palm trees. How I'd have loved to spoil her with beautiful things. On one of her last birthdays, I gave her a wasp's nest that I'd found in the woods. It was all I could afford, a nursery that bugs made and left behind. "I'll get you something better later," I promised. "Of course you will," she said, reaching for her glass. "And whatever it is, I'm sure I'm going to love it." I'm still standing. In the spring of 2017, a passenger seated two rows ahead of me on a plane to Denver shit in his pants. He was old, but not ancient. Early 80s, maybe, and was traveling with a middle-aged woman I took to be his daughter. "Oh, no," I heard her moan. The man responded with something I couldn't catch, and the woman, who was on her feet now, threw up her hands. "Well, I'd say it's a little more than an accident." As the guy shuffled toward the bathroom, I lowered my eyes, the way I hope my fellow passengers will do when it's my turn to soil myself on a crowded airplane. For surely that day is coming. One late morning, the person who's causing everyone to gag will be me. Teenagers will laugh, and as they raise their phones to take my picture from behind, their parents, to no avail, will scold them. The walk of shame, I call it. For it's not the first time I've seen someone slog from their now-ruined seat to the bathroom. A few years back, it was a woman, very nicely dressed, at least in my opinion. She looked like she'd taken her clothes off a long-dead gypsy whose grave she had just now unearthed. And I smiled as she approached, thinking I would say to her, "What an interesting skirt." Then she drew closer and, well... The man who'd shit in his pants went into the bathroom and stayed there, no doubt looking for something to kill himself with. When my turn comes, I'm thinking I'll smash my glasses and open a vein with one of the shards. Because there's no coming back from a thing like that. Does it matter that you'll never see these people again? Even if the plane were to go down, and everyone on it but you were to die instantly, you'd never really recover.
Sir?
15 minutes after the man entered the bathroom, one of the flight attendants began knocking on the door.
Sir, we're preparing to land. I'm afraid you need to come out and return to your seat.
She knocked again.
Sir, are you all right?
For God's sake, leave him alone. I wanted to say, it isn't fair to make him come out and walk past us all another time. Just let him be. The flight attendant either came to her senses and stopped harassing him, or after leaving the bathroom, the man took a seat on the back row. All I know is that I never saw him again. He was on my mind, though. A few weeks after that flight, I was in Dallas having lunch with my young friend Kimberly when all of a sudden, I didn't feel very well. Came out of nowhere. A nausea that caused me to lose my appetite and perspire, though I wasn't particularly hot. I knew of a place not far from here that serves the most amazing pie, Kimberly said. Are you up for a slice? Maybe with some ice cream? I didn't want to say that I wasn't feeling well. It ruins everyone's good time. Besides, I thought, since when has pie made anything worse? Back at my hotel, an hour or so later, I lay on my bed for a while, then raced to the bathroom. I don't know where I'd gotten it from, but I seemed to have contracted a pretty serious gastrointestinal virus. Unfortunately, I had a show to do. 2,000 people were expecting me to pull myself together, get dressed, and stand in front of them for an hour and a half, so that's what I did. It was the first time in my memory that I read while sitting down. The hope was that the pressure of my body might keep everything in. And it was threatening at any moment to gush out. By this point, it was like rusty water. What seemed to be a paint can's worth every time. For 90 minutes, all I thought of was how shitting in my pants in front of that many people was going to feel. Not that it requires a great deal of imagination. It helped, I suppose, that I was behind a podium and that the front row was a good 20 feet away. On the other side of the orchestra pit, audience might never need to know. I'd have to kill the entire stage crew, though. Including poor Kimberly, who was standing in the wings with a bucket in her hands. A bucket. And was the only person I had talked to about my condition. One of the things I thought of that evening, for it is entirely possible to think of other things, and even to do math while reading out loud, was my friend Andy. A few months earlier, he told me that when he was 16... and in his then-girlfriend's rec room with three of their fellow high school students, he started feeling queasy. I think it was food poisoning from some stuffed shells I'd eaten, he said. I was sweating, my stomach started churning, and just as I stood up to run to the bathroom, it poured out of me. Oh, my God, I said. We were at his house eating dinner with his wife and two adolescent daughters, who had heard the story before, but could clearly hear it again every day for the rest of their lives. I mean, their dad shitting in his pants. That's gold. I had to borrow clothes from my girlfriend's brother, Andy told us, his head in his hands, still haunted. Not that he ever wanted them back. The relationship was over the moment I let loose on her family's carpet. That's the kind of thing that would scar a person for life. It's like Carrie level. How are you still not in therapy, I asked. I mean, it's only been, what, 30 years? Andy was in front of four other people, I thought, turning the page and looking up briefly from the podium. Multiply that by 500.
After the reading, there was an equally precarious book signing. Do you ever meet people who have a gastrointestinal virus? I asked a woman after learning that she was a nurse. Oh, yes, she told me. And what do you recommend they do? Well, there's not much you can do, really, she said. Drink plenty of fluids, something with electrolytes like Gatorade, rest. You probably don't feel like eating, but you should force yourself to get something down. That's all I can tell you. I hoped that by the following morning I'd be back to normal, but there was no change. I'd gotten up 3 times during the night and was still passing a paint can's worth of rusty water every 2 hours or so. Where on earth is this coming from, I wondered. My eyes? Do I have great stores of liquid hidden in my neck? My calves? I had to go to Des Moines, so put an extra pair of dark slacks in my carry-on tote bag, just in case the worst happened during the flight. I thought of picking up a ski mask as well. That's what you really need, something to conceal your identity as you make the walk of shame. But in this day and age, on a plane, ski mask would only get you tackled. This while you're already nauseated and plastered with your own feces. The thing about a stomach virus is that it exhausts you. Brushing my teeth wore me out. When it came time to put on my shoes, all I could do was stare down at them and whimper. At the airport, I wanted nothing more than to rest. I couldn't, though, because I had my Fitbit to consider. That and the Apple Watch I wear right above it on the same wrist. Every night it sends me a notice congratulating me on my longest running move streak. I'd met all my requirements. Standing time, exercise minutes, and calories burned for 360 days, and there was no way I was going to ruin my perfect record. The minimum for my Fitbit is 4.5 miles, but for my watch it's closer to 7, hardly an unreasonable distance unless, like me, even standing upright was a challenge. Yet still, after checking my suitcase, I put one foot in front of the other and dragged myself from Terminal A to D and back. Must meet Fitbit and watch requirements, I moaned between clenched teeth, staggering forward. Must be mentally and physically ill at the same time. 2 miles later, I boarded my flight and put what little energy I had back into fearing I might shit in my pants in front of a plane full of people. How is this my life? I asked myself. As I settled into my seat with a bottle of Gatorade, perhaps the greatest indignity of all. What flavor is that? The man beside me asked. I looked at the bottle. Blue? For that's all Gatorade ever tastes like. It's color. Over the period that I had my stomach virus, I tried them all. Blue, red, green, yellow, orange, and a new opaque one that tasted opaque. One of my watch's more irritating features is an hourly reminder to get off my ass. I'll often be at the podium toward the end of a show and feel what amounts to a light tap on my wrist, followed by a message, time to stand up. What do you think I've been doing for the last 80 minutes, I want to shout, wondering where it gets its information from. The watch is seemingly calibrated to whichever plane I'm on. So the moment we hit turbulence or are instructed to prepare for a landing, I can expect the tap. Please sit down and fasten your seatbelts, the flight attendant says. Stand up. and be my crazy slave. The watch counters. I realized not long ago that if I put my hands in front of me and rub the palms together for a minute, the way I might if I were cold or were watching a very slow waiter bring something to my table that I was really looking forward to, I can fool the watch and be rewarded with a "Congratulations, you did it" message. Some would call this cheating, but on an average day, I far exceed my standing goal. So, in my mind, I'm covered. Plus, I only rub my hands together when traveling. At home, when instructed to stand, I do something useful. Empty the scrap bucket into the compost bin. Hang a few shirts on the clothesline. "Did you just do a load of laundry?" he will ask. "No," I tell him. "I just wanted to leave my desk and get a few steps in. Those shirts are dirty." At home, I can adhere more strictly to my beloved routine, which has always been very important to me. More important than anything, I used to think. Then touring came along, aka money, and I decided I could maybe learn to wing it for a while. In an average year, I might spend 3.5 months on the road, more if I have a new book out. "Does Hugh come with you?" people regularly ask. "No," I tell him. "I mean, he'd like to, but what with his wheelchair, it would be pretty hard." The person who asked then nods respectfully, no doubt sorry that he or she brought it up. I have to wash him and feed him and get him in and out of bed. It takes a great deal of time, so when I'm away, I hire someone to do all that for me. Another understanding nod. Sometimes I leave it at that, and sometimes I admit that I'm kidding and explain that Hugh has better things to do than accompany me to Des Moines. "I'm just surprised that you believe the wheelchair business," I say. "Not that there's anything wrong with being a quadriplegic, but given all the times I've mentioned Hugh in print, being paralyzed from the neck down, it's a pretty big thing to leave out, don't you think?" At home, when I get sick or injured, Hugh will usually insist that it's all in my mind. Either that or he'll blame me for it. That was the case when I fell off a ladder. It was Christmas Day, and as I lay on the floor, unable to move or even speak, he stood over me shouting, "Why are you wearing those pants?" As if the legs were sewn together and were the reason I had fallen. "You look like an idiot. And with that shirt, I don't even know who you are anymore." Is now really the moment to get into all this, I wondered? Fairly certain that my back was broken. The time before that, though, he was so kind. This preceded the ladder incident and also took place in Sussex. It was early December, and I was on my daily walk, perhaps 7 miles from home, when I understood that something was wrong. My stomach didn't ache exactly. Rather, it let its presence be known. Then I felt a sudden loss of energy, as if someone had reached inside me and yanked out my batteries. The owner of the house I was in front of had placed large rocks on either side of his driveway and painted them white. The biggest was maybe 6 inches tall. It was uncomfortable to sit on, but I did. And a few moments later, I vomited, grateful that it was almost dark and raining and that no one could see me. Then I did it again, thinking this might be the only vomit in all of England that had no traces of alcohol in it. A novelty, but nevertheless unsightly. And so I covered it up with leaves before struggling to my feet. Hugh's piano teacher lived a few houses away from the rock I'd been sitting on. It wasn't a great distance, but weak as I was, it took a while to reach her front door, then to form a fist and knock on it. Her husband kindly gave me a ride home, where I found Hugh in his studio and vomited some more. "Wow," he said. "You're really sick." He helped me into the house and upstairs to our bed. Then he brought me a bell that I rang every 10 or so minutes for the next 16 hours. "Can I have some water? I think I need a glass of ginger ale." "We don't have any." "I bet the store does." "Bring me my iPad, my laptop, the memoir in my office by a man who had both his feet chewed off by a panda cub." "You couldn't find such a book?" "Maybe I dreamt it. Where's that tea I asked for? Can you change my socks for me?" I thought of Hugh quite often during the period that I had my stomach virus. He doesn't like to talk on the phone, and it's a mistake to push him on it. He'll settle for an email and a pinch, but what Hugh wants when I'm away are letters with stamps on them. If they're patched together entries from my diary, he can tell, and we'll stop reading. So I have to sit down with the express intent of addressing him and only him. I sometimes resent the time it takes, but then I picture him at home taking the letter from Phil, our mailman, and laying it on the kitchen table. He won't read it right away. Rather, he'll prepare for it, sitting in the garden if it's dry, or in his studio if it's not. He'll have a cup of coffee or tea and maybe a biscuit. He's just whipped up, everything just so. The way I am if a New Yorker arrives with a story by Lori Moore in it. Then I'll think of the way he eats dinner when I'm not there, of how he'll spoon the juices of whatever he prepared over the meat or fish and arrange things attractively on his plate. When I'm alone, I'll sometimes eat directly out of the pans with my fingers to save myself from having to wash a fork or a dish. But not Hugh. He always sets the table before sitting down. If it's chilly, he'll build a fire in the kitchen fireplace, and the flames will reflect off his wine glass. Then he'll light candles and eat with the same manners he'd use if invited to Buckingham Palace, a cloth napkin on his lap, not watching a show on his computer or reading anything, but just staring forward at the place where I would be if I were home. Whenever I get tired of having to write him letters, I think of that, him eating alone, and pick up my pen. "Dear Hugh." While sick, I wrote that I wasn't feeling well. I said I worried I might shit in my pants on a plane or while standing at the podium. But even that was testing his limits. Unlike a friend of my brother, who's been known to take pictures of his bowel movements. Hugh and I never discuss what goes on in the bathroom. I have no evidence he's ever done anything in there but brush his teeth and soak in the tub. He won't even let me in when he's peeing. "I had that in my mouth 10 minutes ago. And now it's a private part?" I'll call from the other side of the door. "Yes, go away." If I'd had the gastrointestinal virus at home, I might have said, "I was in the bathroom a lot today." I could have spoken about my nausea and general lack of energy, but that would be the extent of it. I wouldn't use the word diarrhea, as it would be too indelicate. We're well matched in our prudishness. The difference is that while I might not go into detail about myself, I'm more than happy to talk about someone else. This young man I met, for instance, whose girlfriend put her feet up on the dashboard of his truck and accidentally shit in her cutoff shorts. I guess she got a little too relaxed, the guy told me. I don't want to hear this, you said, when I repeated the story. We weren't eating or anything, but even if we were, I wouldn't have understood his objection. This happened years ago, I explained. Thousands of miles away from here. That doesn't matter, he told me. I'm not interested. But no. My gastrointestinal virus lasted for 6 long days, each of which involved at least one flight and an appearance before an audience. Halfway through it, the cramps arrived, some so severe they doubled me over. I thought of my insides as a haunted house with bolts of lightning ricocheting off the walls. The worst of them came when I was in Austin, Texas, walking along a path behind my hotel that ran beside the river. I was trying to get my steps in. And as I stood there, legs crossed, my eyes screwed shut against the pain, it occurred to me that if the floodgates did open, which seemed highly probable, I'd have to jump into the water. Getting out again, wet, covered in mud, I'd likely wish I weren't staying in such a nice hotel. At the La Quinta Inn, you might return to your room unnoticed. But there was no way I could sop through the lobby of the Four Seasons without causing a fuss. A child was drowning. And I jumped into the river to save her, I could say. Don't worry, she's fine now. I just need to go up and change out of these wet clothes. Would they buy it, I wondered, looking out at the brown water? Do I look like the type who could save a child? Should I add more detail? Say, perhaps, that the girl was Mexican? These are the questions you ask yourself when you're traveling with a gastrointestinal virus. Then one day you wake up, normal, restored to health, a miracle. At first you're incredibly grateful, your appetite's back, your energy level. There's a bit of you, though, that misses the razor's edge. The terrible thrill that at any moment you might lose control of yourself and find